Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week, we pick a fascinating new book, and we interview the author of that book. And this week, I'm very pleased to say we have Todd Weir on the show, and we'll be talking about his book, Secularism and Religion in 19th Century Germany, The Rise of the Fourth Confession. Todd, as some of you may know, is also the host of New Books in Intellectual History, and he serves us ably on that channel. But of course, he's also a professor, and he writes books himself, and this is one of them. We've had Todd on the network before, and I'm very glad to have him again. So, Todd, let me welcome you to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Absolutely. So, could you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I came late to history. I studied third world development and such things as an undergraduate, but in the late 80s, I was in East Germany as an exchange student, and my interest in things German quickly became part of history after 1989, and I then went back to Germany and lived there for some years and studied history then finally in the 90s, and went through and got a PhD at Columbia University. And really, I think going back to that interest in East Germany, I was very interested in the history of socialism. And I suppose it's really my own upbringing that I was always interested in utopian movements. So I kind of put these interests together and chose to look at the history of German secularism, which is really a kind of nice way of saying free thought and atheism. Mm-hmm. So these are movements that were very important to German socialists in particular. And so it was a convenient way to examine the relationship between socialism and religion. And that's what brought me to the topic.
Mm-hmm. You said there's something about your upbringing that brought you to utopian ideas. Well, talk about that or not?
Yeah, sure. No, I mean, you know, I was 16. I think I was a very sort of idealistic 16-year-old, and I even had a journal. I used to write a journal, you know, with all of my thoughts and my philosophy, and mm-hmm. I was sitting in suburban Bellevue outside of the city of Seattle, and I remember on a sunny day sitting on a hill and intensively writing down my very important thoughts. And you know, I was an activist in college, and there was the Reagan era, you know, opposed to all of the Reagan intervention in Central America and so on.
Sure.
So
yeah,
it eventually, as it often happens, one's active interests turn into sort of passive academic interests. Yeah. Yeah. So I became a historian of these things that I once thought I was going to do.
Yeah, that's funny. It's funny you mentioned that. We must be about the same age, because I remember when I was in college, I was quite the socialist, and I had a Karl Marx t-shirt and took classes in Marxist economics. I just met with a fellow who I went to college with who she took all of this rather more seriously than I did and has been a socialist organizer his whole life, an American. So, yeah.
Wow, rare.
I remember this. Well, he lives in Vermont, but he travels all over the place talking about socialism to various groups in the United States. His name's Ashley Smith. He's a great guy. Very brilliant guy. Yeah. So those were the days. I try to explain to my students sometimes that there was a time when socialism and these ideas were taken seriously and were just the stuff of history, and they just look at me blankly.
Yeah. Well, although even at that time as Americans, I mean, we were kind of far removed from
the
history of real socialism as in workers struggling for, you know, more rights and for some kind of utopian society. I mean, I think the utopian society bit we had from leftover from the 60s in the U.S., but the connection to the labor unions was pretty much absent in my growing up. So.
Oh, yeah, mine too. But I did live in a kind of a commune in graduate school, so I thought that was all very hip. But anyway, enough about that. Those are bygone days. So tell us why you wrote this book. I mean, you kind of have told us why you wrote this book, but tell us more about why you wrote this book.
Well, I was interested in this question of what's the religious connection to socialism? And I began to poke around when I was looking for a dissertation topic and was going to do something on the 1920s and on sort of radical cultural movements in the socialist sphere. And then I discovered these people called free thinkers and started to want to study them. And of course, as often one does, it's a big mistake for historians. I want to go back to the origins, you know? Yeah. So it took me back eventually to the 1840s. And the book looks at secularism from the 1840s when it emerges up until the First World War. And that's, you know, that's what this book does. And I'm sad to say, we can talk about it later, but I'm still involved in this topic, looking now at the 20th century.
But to go back even further than that, for reasons which I won't go into, I have been reading Marx with my students, and Marx makes pretty clear, or Engels makes pretty clear, I can't remember which, that the sort of original socialist impulses in Europe, at least, were of religious and even Christian origin.
Yeah, the Marxists are interesting because both Marx and Engels...
He doesn't like those people, by the way, but he does say...
They have this distinction between the scientific and the utopian socialists. And for them, the utopian socialists are like Robert Owen and Babeuf and all of these figures who they see as sort of fantastic socialists, not grounded in science and reality. And eventually they see them as tied up with religion. And they see their own brand of socialism as scientific. But of course, as people know who have looked at Marx, I mean, Marx develops his entire edifice of theory out of religious criticism. Mm-hmm. So even Marx and Engels are very much tied up with religious criticism.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's begin by providing some, I guess, vocabulary here. So one of the words is secular, which means worldly, I think, from the Latin. But what is, when we say something is secular in this sort of general sociological sense, what do we mean by that?
Well, as you said, secular would be worldly as against religious in the way that we might use the terms. The interesting thing about the term secularism, obviously ism implies that it's a kind of a belief, a political movement. And that secularism emerges in the 1850s in England as a word appropriated or rather used by freethinkers. So secularism, I chose as the word that I was going to use for this book rather than, say, free thought or atheism, because the way it's defined by George Holyoake, who's this English freethinker, he says that secularism has both a negative aspect, which is criticism of the untruth of dogmatic religion, but it also has a positive aspect, which is a faith in something grounded in science. And so he overcomes this misconception that many people have, including, I think, the new atheists today, when they say that their anti-religious activities are based purely in scientific enlightenment. And what Holyoake very clearly says is that there's also a positive faith implied in secularism. And that was really my starting point for analyzing modern free thought and atheism and these various things, is that it has both a positive, you could call it a religious, ethical side, and a negative, anti-clerical, critical side. Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect of secularism. And the other reason I found it so enticing is that there's a huge literature now emerging, especially in the United States, but also in India and then in the UK, associated with post-colonial theory around secularism. And this entire literature is essentially arguing that the secularization thesis, right, that everything's becoming more worldly and less religious, mm-hmm. that idea that comes out of Max Weber and others, that was does not describe reality, but rather it describes an ideology used by political elites to rule over religious minorities. Mm-hmm. So that the state in the 19th century developed a secular policy where they could stand above the religions by appearing not to take sides in religious struggles. Mm-hmm. So that whole theory of secularism is very, it's a very major part of contemporary political theory. And I found it very interesting to engage with that, because the one thing that those people tend not to look at are the actual secularists. I mean, the free thinkers.
Go ahead.
So that's kind of intriguing, right? The people that call themselves secularists are excluded from the literature on secularism today. And when they talk about secularism, people like the anthropologist Talal Asad and others, what they really mean are liberals who develop a notion of separation of church and state. So the contradiction there, I thought, was kind of intriguing. And I do a bit of investigation of that contradiction. And what it's really about is to try to show, you know, who are the secularists? And the fact is they increasingly in the 19th century are not liberals. They're actually radicals, working class, and then eventually socialists. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's a dynamic that interests me.
Yeah. I mean, I, I, I'm glad you mentioned the New Atheists, because they're an intriguing lot, and I don't think we do a lot of damage to them if we say, well, maybe we do. I don't know. They don't read a lot of history, that much I'll say, at least the ones that I know of and have interviewed. So there's a second term in your book, which is very important, but I think it's kind of lost. I was just talking to my students about this. Confession, what a confession is. My students had no idea what a confession was. They knew what a church was, sort of, but they didn't know what a confession was and what confessionalism might be.
Yeah, well, that comes then out of the German context. So that's where I pick up the German literature, because in German, Confession, the word originally comes, as it does in English, out of Reformation era confessions of faith. So it would be a dogmatic statement. I believe this and that, right? So there'd be the Augsburg Confession and so on from the time of Luther. And out of that, then in the German case, developed a notion in the 19th century that confession really was a way of describing an entire religion. So Catholicism was a confession and Protestantism was a confession. Okay, there used to be two Protestant confessions, but let's forget that. One Protestant confession by the end of the 19th century. So the notion is society is divided up according to religious communities. They are confessions. And the term confession really becomes then tied to people's religious identity, not as, and this is a contradiction, right? Not necessarily in the sense of what's your personal faith, but rather what's your label,
mm-hmm.
right? Which community do you belong to?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's developed now in the last 20 years, a big literature around the role that these confessional labels, these religious labels and community belonging played in German politics. And the argument's been made that it's not just the Reformation era that saw wars of religion, but in fact, in the 19th century, we have a kind of latent war of religion between, say, a Catholic party, the center party, and various liberal parties who tend to be de facto Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did with the term is the subtitle of the book is The Rise of the Fourth Confession. And my argument there is that it's not enough to just look at Protestants and Catholics and how they fight and how they don't get along. That's not the only that does not describe the full playing field when it comes to religion in 19th century politics. We have to include also Jews, right? The third confession.
Mm-hmm.
Other authors have talked about that. The Helmut Walser Smith, for example, talks about the need for a tri-confessional model, including Jews. And what I'm arguing for is a kind of quadra-confessional model that will include secularists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's a really, I would say, if I'm going to sum it up, the big argument of the book.
Yeah. So we've gone through these two things now, and that is what secularism is and what confessionalism is. Could you now, before we actually get to the kind of meat of the book, could you tell us what the confessional order was in, again, we have Germany a little later, but we have Prussia and these other German states, and what the kind of legal order was for people. And it was assumed everybody would belong to one of these, right? I mean, there isn't the assumption that you would be outside this framework. What was the legal framework for this, or constitutional framework?
Right. Great question. You know, and it's so strange, I think, from especially an American perspective, to realize how much religion structured people's rights in early modern society and even in modern society. So coming out of the wars of religion in the 17th century and before, you had these various agreements. And the last major one being the Treaty of Westphalia, where it's agreed that there are going to be, and it varies from state to state, but essentially there are going to be three recognized confessions, Reformed, Lutheran, and Catholic. And if you belong to one of these recognized confessions, your community has certain rights. You can have a church, you can ring bells on Sunday, and you can have public worship. If you belong to a minority group, say the Mennonites or Greek Catholics, then you're going to have fewer rights. You may not be allowed to have public prayers. Your clergymen might not have full rights. They certainly won't receive state salaries. And then sort of at the bottom of the hierarchy in a certain ways is the Jewish communities. And so the Jews would have been not only, say, not allowed to have certain public rights, but also as individuals, they wouldn't be allowed to hold high state office. And the justification would be both a religious one and a one about nationality. They were seen as another nationality. But the religious one was that Jews could not, for instance, take oaths in the court. So they couldn't administer oaths. So a Jew could not become a judge, if for the most part. So that's a bit the sort of legal framework, the constitutional framework coming into the 19th century that dissidents faced. So just to guess your next question, what happens then in the 1840s is that you have the emergence of these groups of Christian rationalists.
That was my next question.
I thought it might be. I was just guessing.
Go ahead.
But anyway, so you have these groups of Christians who are arguing that the Bible needs to be and is ultimately compatible with scientific discovery and scientific reason. And so they're arguing that, all sorts of things, but essentially they want to get away from what they consider dogmatic aspects of Christianity. Okay. That, let's say the virgin birth. Okay. That they'll contest that and they'll say, well, it can't really be the case that Mary was a virgin, you know, so they'll argue bringing science in and they'll try to reconcile in their own way, Christianity and religion. And this for the Orthodox Christians in the 1840s, who are supported by the Prussian state and the king, this is anathema. And so they then, in the 1840s, they're trying to squeeze out these rationalists. And eventually the king of Prussia at the time is effectively forces them out of the church. And instead of giving them the rites of a confession, which would be, say, equivalent to the Protestant church, instead of just forcing them out of the church and saying, go find your own church, he forces them out. But he says, I'm not going to give you the status of a confession. I'm going to effectively give you the status of the Jews. And so effectively a non-confessional status where they have very few rights and they're subjected to police scrutiny and so on. So in this way, he forces the dissidents out of the church and he also politicizes religious dissent at the same time. So that's the kind of initial spark of the whole secularist movement.
And we should just make clear, if let me understand correctly, these people, now there was a lot of anti-clericalism during what we call the Enlightenment. These people were not anti-clerical by and large. They simply wanted to look at things like the scriptures and the revelations in a different way.
Well, anti-clericalism obviously implies also being against the church hierarchy, and often against priests. So the fact is that these are people within the churches who are nonetheless against the church hierarchy. They're against the orthodoxy. So in that sense, they are anti-clerical within a Christian framework. And the same thing is happening in the Jewish communities. You have Jewish dissenters arguing against, say, the Talmud and against certain aspects of the Jewish tradition. So the same thing, they're all arguing in the name of some kind of religion of humanity. They like, that's a term they like to use, the religion of humanity. So it's very quickly politicized. It is radical. They know that they are radicals. The church orthodoxy say, these people aren't even really truly religious. They're just pretending to be religious because they want to make do politics in a way that they can, they will avoid being termed political agents.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, let's address that question just very briefly. I mean, is that a valid argument? I mean, because I was talking to my students about this recently, and, you know, I was like, well, can you be religious without believing in God or without believing in the scriptures? You know, we went back and forth about this, and I don't know. I mean, in that context, were those people religious?
Well, obviously, for the Orthodox, they weren't. The Orthodox, they were, for instance, many of them very quickly gave up belief in the divinity of Christ. And they said he was just a good teacher. He was a very ethical man. He had high standards. He was a philosopher. He was like Plato.
Yeah.
So all those arguments are made. And then, you know, for the truly Orthodox, I mean, whatever, for most Christians, that would be the point at which they stop being Christian. And they might be deists or something of the sort. So it's really I try to avoid any kind of definition of what means to be religious. The reason I do that is because, I think you have to take seriously what the historical actors are saying. And as soon as you apply a label, right, or a test, if I say, do you believe in a transcendental God, or do you believe in a personal God, right? That is a God like a human being. Is that my test for religion? If I apply that test, then I'm going to have to say that many of these people who are involved in a religious organization are not religious.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I avoid that.
I see. So this is, they were tolerated. That's the word, isn't it? What's the word in German? I can't remember.
Toleriert.
They were tolerated, but that's different than the sense in we think of when we say, oh yes, we have religious tolerance in the United States. This is a different thing.
Right. They were tolerated as individuals. I mean, it's a very complicated thing. The legal framework for this dissidence that emerged in the 1840s was, we'll tolerate you as individuals. In other words, you can leave the Catholic Church, you can leave the Protestant Church, and you're not committing a crime. Okay. Prior to that, it would have been, more questionable deed. So there's new legislation. Yes, you can leave the church. No problem. Go ahead. Goodbye. However, if you're a school teacher, if you're an employee of the state, you might lose your job.
Right.
Because why? Well, the argument is the state itself is Christian. It's a Christian state. We have a role to play in divine history, and it would be doing injustice to the citizens of Prussia if the state itself abandoned Christianity.
Right.
Right. Right. So how can we have state officials who are not Christian? Mm-hmm. So the dissidents are going to lose those rights.
Right. Right. So I guess the thing I'm trying to point out is, I don't know if I'm pointing it out, I'm drawing a conclusion, and I don't know if it's true, that if there are four confessions, two of them are actually accepted.
Right.
And two of them are merely tolerated.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And barely tolerated. Yeah. And tolerated as individuals, but not necessarily as religious communities. The Jews are obviously, in a sense, more tolerated because they have rabbis, they have, physical locations. I mean, they have, they're not seen as being a political organization necessarily, whereas the dissidents are on the left for the most part, and they can very often be termed political. And in the 19th century, if you're a political association in Germany, that means you're going to be observed by the police. Mm-hmm. At certain times, it means police are going to come and sit at every meeting you hold, and not only sit there, but sit at the front table in uniform, take notes.
Well, at least they're honest. I kind of like that in a way.
Yeah.
I respect that.
Well, they have spies too. They have spies too, which makes good reading in the archives. Because you get the spies reports, and then you also get the police official report who's sitting at the front. So the dissidents, were always on notice that they could be dissolved at any time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, were these? I'm glad you used the word dissident, because there's a long tradition of dissidents in Christianity. You know, like Luther was one, and so on, and so Zwingli, and blah blah blah. Did they attempt to form what we would call churches?
Oh yes, they had their own congregations. The major, and this is one thing that surprised me really, until 1880, the only free thinking organizations in Germany were called free religious congregations.
Yeah, that surprised me too, Todd.
Yeah. So for the first 35 years of the history of atheism, it's all taking place in churches.
Yeah.
Right? And it's fascinating. You know, you have priests effectively. In the 1870s, arguing using Darwin and Ernst Haeckel that effectively God doesn't exist,
mm-hmm.
and doing this in front of their congregations, and this is all fine, and they there's constant fighting within these movements because some of them are still Christian and some of them still do believe and so on, but there's a drift towards atheism, especially in the big urban communities.
Mm-hmm.
They think of themselves, they hold on to the term religious, partly because they don't want the police to dissolve their organizations,
right.
But partly because they have a new definition of religion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how are these people thought of in their communities? If you just sort of stood up one day and said, I am a religious rationalist, and I am no longer going to be a member of this congregation. Did they heap score? Was there scorn heap upon them, or like, we won't marry your daughter, or that kind of thing?
Well, this is why it's so important to look at the term confession, because you'll have a lot of liberals, right, scientists, who are effectively atheists, right, and they may write journal articles about their atheism and so on, but they don't leave the church. Right. So if you're say you're a university professor and you happen to be an atheist and you're a biologist, you can probably be somewhat frank about your atheism. Maybe not everywhere, but in certain places. But if you actually sat down and wrote a letter and left the church officially, you might lose your job.
Yeah.
Would someone marry your daughter? Yes, as long as you stay in the church.
Uh-huh.
Right. Because you're an atheist, that's fine. That's not necessarily going to be the hindrance. If you know, in the liberal community,
mm-hmm.
So a lot does depend on who is willing to take the step to actually step out of the church, as they say in German, austreten, right, to leave the church,
mm-hmm.
And who's not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. So you mentioned this. I don't know how to characterize it. Slide toward atheism, and I know that something you've written about. And we've talked about before is the movement from Christian rationalism to monism of its couple of varieties. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. Monism is effectively the argument that there isn't a split between the physical world and the mental world, right? That there's no mind-body divide, right? So getting away from Cartesian dualism towards a Spinozan monism, unity. And Baruch Spinoza, who was an early modern philosopher, believed that behind all appearances, there was one unitary substance. And so that effectively the universe was made of a kind of unitary, on some level, was all one, right? Mm-hmm. And for him, God was identical with that oneness of the universe. So what happens in the 1840s is you have a lot of these rationalists under really the kind of pressures of this dissident conflict with the state. They're radicalizing very quickly. And within about 5 years, quite a number of them become monists. And they start to develop a theology of monism. It has all sorts of fascinating aspects. Here's just a random one that was in the book. There's the preacher in Berlin is called Robert Brauner. He's a Catholic priest who becomes the leader of this dissident movement in Berlin in 1845. In 1850, he writes a free catechism. And in there, he says, that effectively, if you see something, the act of perception is based on an identity between the mind and the thing it perceives.
Mm-hmm.
So he's overcoming even Kantian modes of perception somewhat. He says that in order for the spirit to catch fire, in other words, if you see something, let's say art or a political movement, or there's some passion that you witness out in the world, you have an immediate emotional response to it, because in order for the flame to travel, right, and it's a nice optical metaphor, in order for the flame to travel and to catch fire inside of your mind through the eye, there has to be wood bundled in the mind that's the same wood that's burning outside, right? So there's that unity, right, that monist unity that is there before any kind of perception takes place. And so that's just one little example of how this kind of monist thinking works. So for somebody like Brauner, God is, say, expresses his nature through the development of nature in evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So God is a constant revolution through evolution.
Mm-hmm.
There is no separation between God and the world. There is no beyond, right? Mm-hmm. There's no heaven. There's no realm in which God is that we aren't.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this is a kind of monist thinking that crops up. Mm-hmm. And by the 1870s, it's quite widespread. And it even changes then towards a little bit more of a kind of a harder mechanistic scientific rationalist mode.
that we would associate more with, say, Darwinism.
Mm-hmm. So would it be correct to differentiate this view, and I'll characterize this in a second, from modern atheism, or what the modern atheists believe, that is, that there's just nothing? In other words, it seems to me that these early monists, or sort of hardworking Christian rationalists, are saying the scriptures aren't what we think they are, and there is no God in his heaven in the sense that it's described in the Old and New Testament. But you can still develop a kind of religion on the basis of this notion that there's one kind of stuff everywhere. In other words, there's something positive to it. It's not just that there's nothing, but there's something we can say about this that will inform our lives spiritually, whatever that means, and ethically.
Yeah. Yes, I would agree with that. I think that there is, you know, it's a sort of, you can see really steps of this belief emerging already in deism in the 18th century and sort of evolves then in the 19th century under the influence of this cult of natural science, mm-hmm. you know, and this faith that they really are able to have scientific discoveries that are matching this philosophy. Mm-hmm. But just to go to today's new atheists, you know, I've looked a little bit at, say, Daniel Dennett or even Dawkins, Richard Dawkins, and I find that they are quite monistic. I don't find that they say there's nothing. In other words, I don't think that the new atheists argue that natural science disproves not only God, but also disproves meaning in the universe. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at them, it's quite interesting. Somebody like Dennett, both Dennett and Dawkins, I think, are very committed, say, to aesthetic experience of nature. Mm-hmm. They use a lot of, you know, poetic language, rich metaphor. So I think they really are sort of on an aesthetic level trying to create an emotional experience of the totality of nature. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I have a little bit of a different view on the new atheists. I think that they really are, they're not very self-reflective monists. In other words, they haven't done their history, as we were saying at the beginning of the interview. I don't think they've done their history well, but I do think they have a lot in common with these 19th century monists.
Okay, well, I'll agree with you. I don't really know that much about them. I know what I read about them on the BBC or something. So I admit that. You can send me emails talking about my ignorance. No, I have read a little bit of them, and I do follow it a little bit. I'm interested in the question of the new atheism, that's kind of a digression. But so let's talk a little bit about this. There's something in your book called idealistic monism, and I had trouble wrapping my mind around that. What could that be if they don't believe there's a spirit world?
Right. Well, there's a nice, at the very beginning of the history of monism, when the word, say, is first used, which is associated with a early modern philosopher, Wolf, I think it's Christian Wolf in Germany. And he already then recognized that the whole problem with monism is that if you say there's spirit and there's body and they are one, effectively, his argument is that if take a monist and push them, they're always going to claim that one of those is more important, mm-hmm. right? It's always going to be either the spirit is the real monist unity, or they're going to say it's the matter, mm-hmm. right? So that, and the argument that's made, or I make anyway, is that in the early 19th century, you have a lot of idealist monists, right? Hegel is a good example. Schelling, the great German, you know, idealists, in a sense, they have a monist program. The world spirit is evolving, and it evolves through matter, right? It needs to have constant manifestations of itself in matter. But nonetheless, the real driving unity is coming out of spirit. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the mid-19th century, you get all these so-called materialists, Ludwig Büchner being the most famous one, probably. You know, people hear the word materialism, and they think, oh, it's just matter is everything. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it, they always are being monistic. They're always claiming for matter, spirit. Mm-hmm. Right. So the biggest bestseller of materialism in the 19th century is called Kraft und Stoff, right? What's the English title? Power and Matter. Right. I'm sure that's the wrong title. I don't know how we translate it anyway. Mm-hmm. Power and Matter. So the title is suggesting that, say, energy and matter, these dualisms, are going to be overcome through some kind of monistic unity. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of like the idealistic monism versus the
the materialistic monism.
Mm-hmm.
And the big shift really that happens in the middle of the 19th century is the shift towards a more materialistic monism.
So to put it in philosophical language, I don't know if we want to do that, but they're both reductionisms. It just depends on what's being reduced to what.
Yeah. That sounds, right. I agree with you there.
Yeah,
sure.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So there is a strong association, you say, between this increasingly naturalistic monism or materialistic monism and leftist politics. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because it doesn't seem to me that they're, well, I'm hesitant to use this word, but necessarily associated. It seems they're contingently associated. So could you speak a little bit about that?
Sure. I think it goes back. I mean, there's many facets of that, why those two become allied in different ways. But a lot of it has to do with this, going back to the confessional, right? You have a state church, you have a political and social system in which your place in that system depends on your religious affiliations. So in the end, if you're going to be a member of the elite or you want to at least keep your job, you are going to, on a surface level at least, remain true to Christianity. So that opens up, of course, for leftists that want to attack the state, want to attack the social elites. It opens up to them the possibility of embracing a philosophy that is implicitly anti-Christian, right?
Mm-hmm.
So to argue that there is no God, that there is merely the laws of nature, you know, maybe with some kind of big unity of totality of the natural world. But to make that argument, you're implicitly attacking the religious order upon which the state is founded.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So that's certainly a key part of it. There are other facets. Another facet of it is that, to the degree that the left is supported by members of the lower classes or the lower middle classes, there's an educational component to it. If you're an educated factory worker, right? You've had 6 years of primary school. You like to read on the side. If you had your choice between Darwin and Hegel, or even Darwin and Marx, you're not going to read Hegel or Marx because you have 6 years of primary school. But Darwin, you can get your head around.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read somebody who takes Darwin and turns him into a kind of monist worldview, like Ernst Haeckel. Heckel's even better, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they know how to write for the common people. And so it becomes a knowledge that's very powerful for lower middle class people,
mm-hmm.
or lower class people.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sociological element to that knowledge, too. That's important.
Mm-hmm. So there are a few big moments in the last third of the 19th century in German history. And I just want to know about the relationship. You talk about the relationship between these events and the naturalistic monists or the, can we call them secular people at this time? So the first one is obviously German unification. What did the monists think about that, or how did they react to it, or were they for it or against it, or what did they say?
I think these free religious congregations, who are the really organized force at this time, I think many of them did support unification. They're not by majority at this point socialist. The socialists are noted for having, some of them anyway, opposed unification. But what's interesting then is the struggle that takes place after national unification, which is the so-called culture war.
Yeah, that was the second one I was going to talk about. Let's talk about.
Okay, well, just to finish on unification, there's no obvious reason for most of these folks to oppose unification. Certainly if they were Prussian, right, the Prussians were seen as kind of the victors behind unification. So the Prussian free religious, many of them supported it. If they were Southern German and didn't really like the terms of unification, then there's more room for being oppositional. But you wanted to ask me about the culture war?
Yeah, the culture war, yes, that follows.
Well, the culture war is this, it's often known as the inner foundation of the Reich, right? It's the kind of domestic conflict over national identity, right? Okay, now we have the national borders. What is the nature of the state, right? In a place like the United States, we have a really healthy myth, I think, in the United States, right? We have the Declaration of Independence. It's a pretty good place to start, right? So our myth about ourselves is we all love freedom, and you know, that's why we're together, right? Which is okay. Yeah. That's pretty good.
It's a good myth.
Yeah, it's a good myth. The Germans, of course, united with what? A bunch of monarchs got together and unified the country in you know, at the end of the war against France. It's not such an exciting myth. So one of the opportunities that emerges for the Prussians as a way of uniting Bismarck, who's this, you know, radical conservative monarchist. Bismarck sees an opening to work with the liberals, who are the most powerful political party at the time, in anti-Catholicism. And so he opens up a series of attacks on, effectively, on the power of the Catholic Church, and then eventually also with the Catholic Party, the center party, with legislation, discriminatory legislation that is principally aimed at the Catholic Church. It does also affect the Protestant Church, but to a lesser degree. And this is a major event, actually, in the formation of modern politics in Germany. And it's usually, you know, interpreted as a bi-confessional conflict, right? It's a conflict between Protestants and liberals, who are usually Protestant, and the Catholics. And what I said is in the book is I said, well, you know, what about the secularists? What about these dissidents, right? How do they fit in? And what I found was that already at the very beginning of this culture war, these secularists are already pushing an anti-Protestant agenda as well as an anti-Catholic agenda. And liberals are actually okay with this for the most part, but that at the crisis point of the Kulturkampf, which comes around 1877, 1878, liberals start to get very queasy about this relationship to secularists, right? Secularists are drifting towards the socialists, and the liberals start to really back out of the Kulturkampf. And, you know, most historians see the fact that liberals backing out of the Kulturkampf as partially a victory of Catholic defense. The Catholics had defended themselves effectively against this onslaught. But what I'm arguing is we need to really look at the quadra-confessional aspects, right? The fact is that there's a new force emerging from the left, which is socialism, and it has their kind of religious face, which is called secularism, and it doesn't really sit with the liberals very well. And that, for me, is a key element of why liberals begin to buckle and the Kulturkampf fails.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So then there's a kind of a third thing here. I mean, maybe it's that I studied this at one time, and Germany is, of course, I was going to call it the home of European socialism. I don't know if that's true or not, but the SPD, the German Socialist Party, grew very large. And then, of course, there were anti-socialist laws. And since many of the people who practiced free religion or monism or however you call it were socialists, how did it, or at least they were on the left, how did it affect them?
Right. Well, in that period of the height of the Kulturkampf, we start to have some socialists who are going to start using dissidents as a political tool, uh-huh. right? And so we have somebody like Johann Most, who is later the most well-known anarchist, probably a German anarchist of the 19th century. He goes to New York and becomes John Most. At any rate, Johann Most leads a campaign against the Protestant Church in 1878 as a radical socialist. And he says that we have to strike at the state churches using this weapon of dissidents, right? Have people leave the churches. In the end, that kind of backfires because that is one of the key elements that Bismarck then uses to justify the socialist laws, the laws that come in later that year to take away rights from the Socialist Party and to sort of effectively, you know, push it into the shadows for a number of years. So there, you know, there is this political connection born out of this kind of, you know, homologous structure, right? You have on the one hand discrimination against religious dissidents, on the other hand you have discrimination against political dissidents, socialists, and so there's an affinity there. But the socialist leaders realize in the 1880s that it's not really to their advantage to have a very overt relationship with secularism. because, you know, they want to be able to make inroads, say, with Catholic workers. And it's not going to write atheist on their foreheads and march into the Catholic neighborhood isn't going to really do very well. So they back off.
I see. So we've talked about the relationship between these secularists and socialism on the one hand, and then we talked Protestant and Catholicism. And at the book, you go on at some length about the opinions about and relations Jews. That is the third of the fourth confession you talked about. So can you lay bare for us those relations?
Sure. Well, the interesting thing about the end of the Kulturkampf, right, that as soon as the struggle with the Catholics kind of recedes, it's the birth moment of anti-Semitism as a modern movement. And that term is coined in 1878, which is the year that the Kulturkampf fails, right? So I think there's a relationship here between the end of one chapter of this confessional struggle in the 19th century and the beginning of another. Mm. And really, it goes back to this confessional system. The Jews had been discriminated against by the Christian state. Okay, and so Jews became associated in the minds of many Germans and in the minds of many Jews with religious dissent, because the religious dissenters in the 1840s, the Christians, effectively received a discrimination similar to that the Jews were suffering under. So there was a natural affinity between Jewish emancipation and emancipation of dissidents. And liberals would argue that case, right? That both of these minorities needed to have full rights in a modern liberal democracy, or at least a modern constitutional monarchy. So that was a key claim that liberals made. So in the minds of Christian conservatives, they understood Jewish emancipation to be a threat, perhaps greater than the threat of the dissidents. They thought that if you gave Jews emancipation, you would destroy the Christian foundations of the state. Mm-hmm. The same way that if you allowed atheists to be judges, you would destroy the Christian foundations of the state. So I think that in the minds of Christian conservatives, alongside all of the other stereotypes about Jews and prejudices, there was this confessional argument that was being made by conservatives. And I then show how even leading liberal anti-Semites like Heinrich von Treitschke in 1879, he starts to talk suddenly about the religious elements of the German identity. Right? Before that, he had been a good liberal. He thought that what would unify Germany was going to be, you know, national strength and a liberal constitutional order. Mm-hmm. In the late 1870s, he starts to say, well, the real essence of the German people is a Christian spirituality, a Christian identity. Mm-hmm. And then he's an anti-Semite, and he argues that the Jews, in fact, are behind all of the things that are destroying Germany. Mm-hmm. So I look at various ramifications of anti-Semitism and the way in which there's all of this kind of anti-secularism percolating up through it. Mm-hmm. And then I even go and look at the secularists. If you want, we can go to that, but that's another whole can of worms, philo-Semitism.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about that, because it's fascinating.
Well, philo-Semitism describes those people. Again, particularly non-Jews. I suppose you could have philo-Semitic Jews, but that sounds a bit odd. But philo-Semites would be ones who have a positive, envisions a positive relationship to Jews that is going to then serve their own political ends, right? So the philo-Semitic secularists, which were a lot of these free religious people, they believe that if the Jews would convert to free religion, that they could not only solve the so-called Jewish problem or the Jewish question, but they could also fulfill the religion of humanity. Mm-hmm. So Jewish conversion was tied up with this notion of a universal German humanity, religion, and it was also seen as a way of overcoming religious difference that the Jews would no longer be their own separate community. So there's all these kind of interesting ways in which that works out in intellectual history. So you have a lot of these materialists arguing that secular Jews should embrace materialist worldview or monist worldview. And then you have Jewish secularists who are also organized in these free thinking associations saying, well, you know, worldview, it's too dogmatic, right? So you start to have a criticism of this dogmatism of worldview, which is really there, from these Jewish liberal freethinkers. And my thinking is that behind it is this recognition by a lot of these Jewish liberals that belief in worldview, or let's say confession of worldview, is similar to giving up Jewish identity. And so they start to develop a new notion of spiritual unity for secularists. They start to develop the notion that ethics is going to be the mode that is going to bring German secularists together. And the reason ethics is different from worldview is that in their arguments, ethics is going to be derived not in contrast to religion, but rather out of religion. Mm-hmm. So the ethical precepts of all religions are going to be studied. And we're going to recognize that there are, say, shared ethical precepts between the various monotheistic religions. Mm-hmm. So theoretically, I guess Islam, but certainly Judaism and Protestantism, perhaps even Catholicism, we're going to recognize that there are shared ethical values that are going to allow us to establish a spiritual unity. Mm. So Jews can stay Jews, Protestants can stay Protestants, Catholics can stay Catholics, but we will all agree to meet on the higher plane of ethical society or ethical culture. And I think that important in that is not only the fact that there are many liberal Jews involved in developing that discourse, but I think also that it is specifically taking place against the notion that there is one universal worldview that everyone has to subscribe to. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I don't know. It strikes me that that's a very circuitous route to what looks a lot like modern liberalism, if you see what I mean. In other words, yes, it is true that there are a lot of religions. They do kind of contradict one another. They generally believe the same thing. You can belong to whatever congregation you want. That's fine with us. As long as, you know, you kind of generally adhere to this principle of this sort of code that we claim derives inductively from all of your specific confessions.
And there's an interesting American part of the story, too, which is that this movement of ethical culture, which is one of these secularist movements I examine, it had its origins in the United States, in New York, by a rabbi. And Felix Adler came from a German family. I think he was even born in Germany, even went back to Germany for his university education, came back as a free religious preacher, preached to his temple congregation in New York in the same time period, 1877, and was more or less chased out. Because he was effectively a kind of, you know, deist, atheist in the eyes of this congregation. Mm-hmm. And then he founds this movement called ethical culture. And I think you're right. I think there are a lot of elements of ethical culture that do speak to a kind of general liberal standpoint, which we might term after World War II, something like secular humanism.
Yeah, exactly. No,
But I think that's something that evolves, you know, I think that in the 19th century in the United States as well, religious toleration wasn't the order of the day. I don't know American history very well, but I think there was a lot of religious intolerance.
No, there wasn't. I think you're right about that. I was speaking of a little bit later period.
Yeah.
And almost the present, because that's kind of what we believe today. We see a lot of people of different religions, and we might even be religious ourselves. But I think that, and I don't want to be too explicit about this because I don't really know, that there's this general sense, at least in the United States, that we all sort of believe in the same ethical code, despite our denominational or sectarian differences.
Right, which is, I suppose, a very, I don't want to use the word, but I will, pragmatic, maybe, a tradition that's not, this doesn't have necessarily a very deeply rooted philosophical grounding, except maybe this kind of faith in the original documents of the American Revolution and the Constitution and so on. But what's interesting about the Ethical Culture Society in Germany is that, for my money, they're still working within the same mental framework as the monists. Mm-hmm. They still want to have some kind of spiritual unity of the nation. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, it may be that in American public sphere, there's an assumption about a commonality, right? And I think that there's, you know, John Rawls and all those kind of liberal thinkers of the recent past who talk about shared values as an important element of polity, mm-hmm. and the American polity in particular. Mm-hmm. But in Germany, in the, before World War I, certainly, this notion of a spiritual unity is shared across the board, right? Mm-hmm. By liberals, by these worldview monists, by, you know, radical atheists, and by these ethical culture people.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point. I think it's the case that the American notion of hands-off religion, that is a very strong separation between church and state, that doesn't really come to Europe, if it's come to Europe even today, until much later.
Right.
Yeah.
I agree.
So can you talk a little bit about, the book concludes, can you bring us kind of up, or should I say after 1914, what happens to the secularists?
Well, the there is a revolution in 1918 at the end of the First World War, and you have the Weimar Constitution is written in 1919. During the revolution, you have some really very important free religious secularists appointed to high positions because they're socialists, and they kind of, it's a bit of chance and their own desire to get there, but they announce a radical separation of church and state in 1918 in Prussia. But that is soon, the churches then actively get involved in countering that, and the it's taken back. Mm-hmm. And effectively, the Weimar Constitution is a compromise solution between socialists who want full separation and the liberals and the religious parties who don't. So what you have is you have declaration of a separation of church and state, and at the same time, you have a continuation of all the privileges that churches held under the old system. You have church tax being organized by the state. The clerics are members of, they're paid by out of state, effectively out of these state funds, church state funds. The churches continue to hold control over theological faculties and universities, and so on and so on and so on. They still oversee elements of school education. Most German children are still in confessional schools. So there were all of these various reasons as to why this movement of free thought could come back at the end of the Weimar Republic. And you have a period of, as everybody knows, at the end of the Weimar Republic, we have the emergence of National Socialism. We have the emergence of strong communist movement in Germany. They're contending. There's almost a state of civil war in the last 3 years of the Weimar Republic. And, you know, one of the things that I'm interested in studying now is really the role of religion in that latent civil war. And that's the period in which these free thinkers become very active again. That's the period at which the Communist Party embraces anti-clericalism as one of their chief strategies to try to attack the existing order of Germany. And what's interesting at that period is that the Nazis make really great inroads with a lot of Christian believers, mm-hmm. and particularly Protestants. Mm-hmm. And so one of the elements that I'm interested in is, well, what role does anti-secularism play in the embrace by Christians of National Socialism, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And that seems contradictory because everybody thinks the National Socialists are atheists themselves, kind of monists, which is true of many of them. But what's interesting about the Nazis before 1933 is that they really try to show very strongly that they are going to destroy secularism. So even though they draw philosophically from elements of secularism, they champion the anti-secularist cause. Mm-hmm. And unlike some of the traditional conservatives, they're quite serious about it. And when they get into power, they fire secularist teachers, they close secular schools. So they're really showing to the Christian conservatives that they mean business. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Christians flocked to the Nazis in this time period.
And so it's very interesting. So thank you very much for being on the show and talking about the book. We have a traditional final question on New Books in History, and you've already touched on what you're going to work on next, or you are working on next, but maybe you could just fill us in. What are you going to work on next, or what are you working on next?
Right. Well, right now I'm writing a book that is, I suppose, in many ways a sequel to the one that I've just described to you. So it does look at that period of the Weimar Republic, and it's going to focus really on the relationship of socialism to secularism and go from around 1890 up until 1933. Mm-hmm. So that's the next book. But I'm also working then on a project on the history of worldview. So again, it's a related topic, but this one will go up to the present, and I'm interested in the ways in which through arguments over worldview, and really the term worldview in Germany, but also in the US and in Russia, through arguments over the term worldview, you actually have a dialogue going on between religious thinkers and secularists, or say religious thinkers and socialists, about what is the relationship between the sacred and the profane in modernity? Mm-hmm. I think it's a really interesting way of, through this notion of a kind of war between secularism and religion, we notice that together, that in their struggle, they're actually developing whole ways of understanding the world. Mm-hmm. So I think if you in the year 1800. If you were to try to articulate something like worldview to a German commoner, they'd have no idea what you're talking about. I think the term worldview itself gave people the framework to think about religion and the world in totally new ways. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And I think that took place in the religious camp and in the secular camp. And what's very fascinating about this is that that term is appropriated in the late 19th century by especially evangelical Christians. And evangelical Christians start to talk about a Christian worldview. And what they mean, and this shows why it's important that you have the term worldview, they're basically recognizing that theology, right, divine history, it's not enough. Right? To understand God and his relationship to man and Jesus and so on, that's not enough. We need to be able to explain the physical world. We need to be able to explain, I don't know, sexuality and various other things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so they begin to talk about something called a Christian worldview, and it's expanded, and it's exactly mapped onto what it is the seculars have. And if you look today, if you go to the bookshelves of any, or rather go to Google, type in worldview, in terms of titles being published with that in that term in the title, I'm just guessing a third of them are written by evangelical Christians.
Interesting. Yeah, I wouldn't have said that.
Yeah, so it's a fascinating sort of side story, and that book would then go all the way from 1790 from German philosophy all the way up to the present, mm-hmm. and look at all of the ways in which through this term, there's all these dialogues going on about religion. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds fascinating, and I hope that when you're done with both of those books, you'll come back on the show. I'm sure that you will.
I'd be happy to.
All right. That's great. So thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, Marshall.
Absolutely. And let me say to everyone who listens to this podcast, thank you very much for tuning in. You've been listening to New Books in History, and I'm Marshall Poe, the host of the channel, and I hope that you have a great week.